So this talk is a little different. There's no animals. No animals in this talk. But the system still applies to an integrated system. So at least I will give you that. So apologies for no cattle running around. This is research that we've conducted in eastern Nebraska, or the western corn belt, at a long-term study site. And it's primarily talking about biomass feedstocks. And why is this relevant to livestock and integrated crop livestock? Even though the bioenergy industry is still developing, it's a potential competitor for those biomass sources that would be produced on our landscapes. So currently we think of our biomass feedstocks being forest-based, agriculturally based, as in residues, or dedicated bioenergy feedstocks, as we've heard about some perennial grasses and short rotation woody coppice plants. And the energy crop supply itself is estimated to be anywhere between 80 to 400 million dry tons of material per year as what we are being what's being projected. So one of those dedicated perennial crops, or one of those dedicated energy crops, could be in the form of perennial bioenergy grasses. And these are very attractive, not only because they have the potential to reduce greenhouse gases by having a high biomass production and mitigate these climate changes, they also have a very wide range where they can grow. But as you can see from this diagram, that's also prime farmland. So the idea of not just the perennial grasses being there to produce bioenergy stock, and in some cases, what would make good bioenergy stock for energy would also be good for grazing, is that one of the places that we could target for these plants to be grown is on idle cropland, or cropland that we would classify as being marginally productive, where the inputs for production wouldn't necessarily make sense for a producer. Why pour money into acres that's not going to give you a return on your investment and yield? So on these marginally productive lands, even though idle cropland is 14% of the total U.S. cropland base, about 85% of that land is enrolled in the Conservation Reserve Program. And that reserve program is used for wildlife protection, pollinators, and a great number of other things. And it's been estimated that over 8 billion tons of soil erosion have been prevented by CRP, because CRP is located in those very environmentally sensitive landscape zones. And in 2010, it was estimated that about 52 million metric tons of carbon dioxide was sequestered just due to reduced fuel use alone, that those acres were not being farmed. So no machine passes, no fertilizer use, those were avoided carbon dioxide numbers. When we get closer to home, where the study was conducted in Nebraska, since 2007, CRP acreage in Nebraska has decreased by 45%. This is a nationwide trend. And a lot of these trends are due to just the fact that farmers are, well, when commodity prices were higher, they were breaking out CRP, leaving their contracts once their contracts were completed, and going back to row crop. What we see in Nebraska is a unique opportunity where we have this integrated system where Nebraska has a very, very strong row crop agriculture industry. We're also really big meat producers, and so we've got a very active livestock industry. And we happen to be in a place where we produce a lot of ethanol, so we have a lot of ethanol activity. So we get this nice confluence of different industries. That also means that we have a confluence of competing interests for similar livestock, for similar feedstocks. And so this is where some of the research that we are interested in come in to play, where we want to know what the long-term impact is of making management decisions on these marginally productive lands, on the carbon intensity of these different systems. Why is this special? One, long-term data is something that we need, because we want well-equilibrated systems that would be representative. of what and actually expressing management changes or these differences in management. And we want to look at the carbon intensity of these systems by looking at as many angles as possible, which is doing our best to put together, it's not exactly an LCA, but we're getting close, changes in soil organic carbon, soil greenhouse gas emissions or direct emissions, and then the fuel use and fertilizer manufacturing contributions that go into managing those systems. And the nice part about this study is that these are side-by-side comparisons of looking at no-till continuous corn with and without stover removal, and then looking at bioenergy switchgrass. In fact, we have two different cultivars of bioenergy switchgrass there. So here's our study. I'll refer to it as 9804 because it was established in 1998, the fourth study established in 1998, very original. It's our long-term bioenergy study. It's located in Ithaca, Nebraska, at the University of Nebraska's Eastern Regional, Eastern Nebraska Research and Extension Center, NREC. The study is in three replicates in a split plot design where the main treatment is no-till corn or two different cultivars of switchgrass, Caven Rock, which has been there since the beginning of the study in 1998, and Liberty. Liberty is a bioenergy cultivar that was developed at the university or in the ARS at the University of Nebraska. And I will say at this point that Liberty is essentially what we're going to refer to as a rotational grass, because Liberty was not planted at the study until 2012. It was during the drought year, and it was very difficult to establish in 2012. And the reason why we did that was prior to Liberty, there was another cultivar switchgrass called Trailblazer, and it simply did not last. About year 8, year 9 after the grass had been there, it began to fail. And so at that point, we decided to replace that with this bioenergy switchgrass. The split treatment here is nitrogen rate that's applied as granular urea. It's knifed in our corn plots, or it's surface applied in our switchgrass plots, and it's at 0, 60, or 120 kilograms of N. And then our split treatment is the harvest treatment, where in our switchgrass plots we have two different harvest times, one in August, post-anthesis, and that one at post-killing frost, a little bit later in the year. And then corn, we have no stover removal, or 50% of stover being removed. For the purposes of the data that I'm presenting today, I'm just going to look at post-killing frost harvest and 50% residue removal in the corn. And the reason why I selected those two treatments in the split design is because those are the two treatments that are most likely to reflect the actual removal of biomass from the landscape. This is what industry would be looking for. So specifically, what are our questions? How does crop type and specific agronomic practices affect biomass production and the global warming potential of these diverse management systems? And so what we're comparing here is this perennial versus this annual crop, fertilizer rates, and then the biomass removal rate and timing. And then to calculate global warming potential and CO2 equivalents, what is it that we need to be measuring? So what we have is we're going to estimate the total energy use based on the number of machine passes that we have and the application rates that we know that we have. We measured soil greenhouse gas emissions in this system, so we have empirical data there. And we've also measured long-term changes in soil organic carbon stocks. So the basic equation is the global warming potential of that system is your energy usage plus the greenhouse gas emissions from that system, from the soil, minus whatever change in soil organic carbon stock occurs over time. And you hope that that's that number is positive, that you have a lot of gain in carbon. So how do we quantify fuel usage? Again, it depends on your equipment size, your equipment type, the number of passes that you're using, and the operation type and the intensity of that operation. But what we're going to do is take the carbon intensity to convert that fuel and energy use to CO2 emissions, and this came from the 2016 California Air Resources Board numbers. And just as an example, here are some of the CO2 emissions that are resulting from planting or agrochemical application or grain harvesting or biomass removal. Soil greenhouse gas emissions, we are looking at direct emissions, similar to what Chris was showing. We use the same type of very similar anchors and setup, where we're looking at three different gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous. And we know from many studies that management are going to affect how soil greenhouse gases are being emitted. And again, here, we're going to focus on methane and nitrous oxide emissions, primarily because carbon dioxide emissions, even though they're the largest fluxes coming from these soils, soil organic carbon change is the better indicator of net changes in carbon over time. So how did we do this direct greenhouse gas emissions? We're using the GraceNet protocol. So we have standard chamber measurements every week during the growing season, biweekly early and late in the season on either side, and then monthly during the non-growing season. So even in the snow, we're out there and we're taking measurements. As part of the measurements, we're also we'll look at the daily rates, but we also calculate the cumulative emissions from those daily rates over the course of a crop year, from the day of planting to the day before planting of the next year. And then ancillary data that we collect at the same time, air temperature, soil temperature, volumetric water content, which we take with a TDR, time domain reflectometer, at 10 centimeters depth. When we quantify changes in soil organic carbon, as I said earlier, even though CO2 emissions are very, very large, net changes in ecosystem C are best quantified by looking at carbon stock changes over time. So at this study site, we've had periodic soil sampling, either soil surface sampling to 30 centimeters every 3 to 5 years, and then deep soil sampling down to 150 centimeters about every 10 years. So we want to know not just what's going on in the surface, but also what's going on to depth. So what did we find? We looked and have been measuring greenhouse gas emissions at this site since 2010, but that was just a partial year, so we're starting here in crop year 2011, and data is still ongoing in collection. So in those five cropping years between 2011 and 2015, we had 94 different sampling events. And for those two gases that we had a mean rate of about 6 grams of N per hectare, or of which 69% of those daily flux rates were true non-zero fluxes. And in fact, 2% was consumption. And then methane, we had some pretty large fluxes there, but relative to nitrous, they're very, very small. And again, as opposed to nitrous, these were mostly consumption because these are upland aerobic soils. And we would find peak fluxes of nitrous occurring 1 to 3 weeks after fertilization, and then when the soil was relatively warm and moist, as you would expect. And then we had hot spot fluxes for methane, which, excluding that date, there were no correlations between methane emissions and water-filled pore space or soil temperature. So I'm just going to go back and concentrate on direct emissions. If we took all those data and we compile them into cumulative annual emissions, what we find is that as we increase our nitrogen fertilization rates, you see a concomitant increase in the nitrous oxide emissions, as you would expect. But I also would like to point out there's a lot of interannual variability over those five crop years that are occurring in all of those cropping systems. If we take that five-year mean, again, we still see that nitrous oxide emissions increases with nitrogen application rate, and that the emissions factors, when we subtract out the zero N control for the 60N treatment, they tend to be below the IPCC numbers, and then for the 120N, they tend to be above. SOC stocks, what we find over time is that almost all the systems gained or maintained or gained C since the beginning of the study. The stover retention, of course, increased carbon storage, and increasing your nitrogen fertilization rate also increased your carbon storage because you got more biomass. So So we take all that, put it together, and look at the global warming potential of these systems, and what do we find? No-till corn tends to be greenhouse gas neutral or it's a slight source on these marginally productive soils. Switchgrass tended to be greenhouse gas sinks, and they're enhanced being a sink by adding a little bit of nitrogen, except for Cave and Rock at 120N. That nitrogen application rate, way too high. So the nitrogen that's not being utilized by the plant is being released to the atmosphere. So just repeating what we saw there, that the switchgrass or greenhouse gas sinks, and then no-till corn was small source. And although soil organic carbon storage is indeed a main driver for which direction global warming potential of these systems go, nitrous oxide emissions will tip the scale in one direction or the other, whether it's a source or a sink. And so for the sake of time, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up here. Below ground inputs, roots, and exudates, we believe that those are the sources of the carbon that's being stored in both row crop and perennial systems. So, thank you very much.